be wary about names that come out, because often law enforcement officials are wrong. That's one thing. I think another thing is there's almost never a second gunman.
Advice on how to consume news after a gunman strikes. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also on this week's show, don't think that just because you're a law-abiding American citizen, you can't be detained and harassed at the border.
I was like, he's my husband. You need to tell me where he is going. We waited here 6 hours. Don't treat us like we're criminals. Don't treat us like we've done something wrong.
And an app called Ghetto Tracker makes decisions about which neighborhoods are, quote, bad. But at least it's transparent about it.
Whereas we already have tools that are doing the same thing, but are using algorithms to do it. And no one is talking about those.
There's more OTM coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Someone dressed in a black top, black jeans. What does that say, if anything, about a possible motive or whatever? Can we begin to draw any initial conclusions? And I want to alert our viewers, sometimes these initial conclusions can obviously be very, very wrong.
The initial coverage of the mass shooting at the Washington Navy Yard Monday by contractor Aaron Alexis bore all the earmarks of classic reportage in the midst of these all-too-frequent horrors. It stunk.
We're looking at a situation possibly involving multiple shooters here at the Washington Navy Yard.
Wrong.
It's believed that whoever this gunman is, a man in his 50s who is carrying three weapons, a handgun, a shotgun, and an assault rifle.
Wrong about his age. Wrong about the assault rifle.
Earlier today, some media outlets were tweeting out that the shooter was a man named Raleigh Chance.
Now that is dangerously wrong. Breaking news, whether of a violent storm or a vicious gunman, creates chaos and confusion. That's a given. But what the news media do in the face of it, that's a choice. And they pretty much make the same choice in every medium, on every platform, in every era.
Rumors ran rampant. At first, it was thought that Vice President Johnson had also been shot in the attack.
During the JFK assassination, if you listen to the radio broadcasts, they sound as uncertain as Twitter reporters sound when they're reporting if he's alive, if he's dead.
Rebecca Greenfield writes for the Atlantic Wire.
A reporter in Dallas goes back and forth on it. At one point, they report that there were three shooters there. It goes all the way back to the reporting of the Titanic, even. There were false telegraphs saying that the Titanic hadn't sunk, and that it was on its way to Halifax safe.
The new media environment means everyone gets to report or disseminate news of disaster. Some report well, some badly, but all are retweeted. So listen up. Some of this is on you.
When a breaking news situation is happening, you really should pay attention to certain key words that members of the media may use because they mean very distinct things.
Andy Carvin is the senior strategist on NPR's digital desk.
So for example, if they say, we're receiving reports that XYZ has happened, that should suggest to you that some of their sources are claiming something, but it's not necessarily confirmed. Whereas if they then say, we can confirm that such and such has happened, that means that they feel that their sourcing is strong enough that they can go out on a limb and claim that this is an actual fact. And there are all sorts of words that they may use in between, such as, it appears that such and such has happened. So they're feeling somewhat confident, but they still haven't necessarily confirmed it either.
What about CNN has learned?
One of the things that you will sometimes hear during breaking news is the phrase, CNN has learned or NPR has learned. While it may not seem like a big deal, it's their way of saying we have some sort of scoop. So on the one hand, it could mean that they do have a scoop and they're the first ones to confirm something. Or they're going out on a limb and reporting something that no one else has felt comfortable reporting yet.
A shooting where NPR got it initially wrong was reporting that Congressperson Gabby Giffords had died.
In a fast-changing news situation with conflicting reports, we should have been more cautious. NPR News apologizes to the family of Representative Giffords and to you, our listeners.
which is why it's also important to listen to whether or not they're claiming what the source is. So, for example, if they say, we're receiving information from law enforcement sources or law enforcement officials, if they're not going on record with that law enforcement official's name, then it's still essentially speculation. Whereas if they say, officer such and such at a press conference 5 minutes ago said XYZ, that means the officials have gone on the record with their names and the information that they have.
Unnamed sources led CNN up the path to perdition by wrongly claiming a suspect had been apprehended in the Boston Marathon bombing. And unnamed officials wrongly fingered Ryan Lanza, the actual shooter's brother, as the gunman at Sandy Hook. But named officials maligned the citizens of New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. In the first hours of mayhem coverage, trust no one. News consumers longing for certainty should just learn to live with the pain. As Carvin says, mark our words, meaning the media's words, and learn from experience, even if we don't.
First off, they should be wary about names that come out, because often shooters are using different IDs, or often the law enforcement officials are wrong.
Ian Fisher is assistant managing editor for digital operations at the New York Times.
Be wary of organizations that blindly quote other organizations without solid sourcing. They aren't taking a very big chance in doing that. They can always say, oh, that was them, not us. Another thing is there's almost never a second gunman.
It's like House on the TV show saying it's never lupus.
Right. It's it's never lupus. There's almost never another gunman.
Craig Silverman, author of the Poynter Institute's Regret the Error blog, has just written a piece which he plans to run every time there's a crisis. It's called, This is My Story About the Breaking News Errors That Just Happened.
And it just basically will fit pretty much any breaking news error situation in the future.
Okay, so what happens every single time?
So misidentification of people, usually of victims of perpetrators, very consistent. We'll often see mistaken numbers in terms of the number of victims, in terms of the number of perpetrators, and that kind of thing as well. Sometimes location is incorrect, where something originated, where something is happening now. Mistakes also related to images. So fake images that are portrayed as real, or images that were taken previously and sort of find their way to be presented as if they're new. So that's very consistent as well.
As you know, big news brings out the fakers.
Absolutely. And this is a really important thing for both journalists and for people consuming media in these moments to realize is that there are lots of hoaxers who know that in this moment, people are just grabbing onto whatever image they can find. So they might Photoshop something and send it out. What we commonly see in weather situations is now what I call the street shark, where people will claim to see in a flooded street or highway a shark swimming. So beware of street sharks.
So who should we trust?
Well, a little bit of no one and a little bit of everyone. People on the ground, that's always your preferred source. Have they actually seen it with their own eyes? Are they actually there? And do they know the area? Really, really important.
But not guaranteed. I'm tempted now to play another montage here of bad reporting of the Boston Marathon bombing, the Sandy Hook shooting, the Oregon Mall shooting, the Aurora, Colorado shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting, and Columbine. But I won't, because the exercise would be more depressing than illustrative. Instead, we'll put a chart on our website to post by your TV or radio or computer to consult when next confronted with a blood-saturated lead. Because innocent people are shattered by guns, but also by the buckshot of frenzied media, social media included. Take note of the words. We're receiving reports, an unnamed official says. Another news outlet reports, experts speculate, and of course, second gunmen. Mostly, they're just buckets of blather deployed to fill that aching void. So print out our little chart, and may you never need it. But you will. Coming up, what OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman learned about her civil rights at a U.S. border crossing. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website or online portfolio for business or personal use. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready with 24/7 support, domain names, and e-commerce all included on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media. On the Media is supported by The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about The New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, we brought you a story about violations of civil liberties at our borders and promised we would follow up this week with some answers about what rights we actually have. The next story is our attempt at that answer. On Labor Day, OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman was headed back to New York from her cousin's wedding near Toronto when she was detained along with a carload of family and friends for 6 hours without explanation by U.S. Border Patrol agents at Niagara Falls. Everyone in the car was a U.S. citizen. Here's what happened at Niagara Falls and what she learned and didn't learn after.
Once we realized we wouldn't be leaving the border facility anytime soon, the giddiness we still had from the wedding weekend quickly disappeared.
Head started to slump between shoulders. All conversations ceased. I remember at one point trying to fall asleep, but I was just so cold. I couldn't do it.
Sufyan Amri was one of the 6 people in our car.
I felt like they were a bunch of frat boys, and we were a bunch of initiatives just sitting there awaiting their judgment. Because I remember they would snicker and kind of look at us and comment, and they would kind of whisper among themselves and laugh.
It was freezing. I felt like I had goosebumps the whole time I was there.
That's Abdullah, my husband.
Everybody was like putting their arms in his shirt, and there's points where my teeth were chattering.
There's probably no form of Border Patrol abuse that's better documented than that. People have reported being held in extreme cold, and they call it the ice box.
James Lyle is an attorney at the ACLU of Arizona. He says in addition to the ice box, people have reported physical and verbal abuse, as well as denial of food, water, or medical care by Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, which is under the Department of Homeland Security.
The accounts are so widespread and so consistent that it's very hard to see this as anything other than a systemic problem and not just a couple of bad apples here or there.
Lyle told me the story of 4-year-old Emily Ruiz, who was detained for 20 hours at Dulles Airport.
She was crying hysterically, and agents refused to let her speak with her parents for over 14 hours. They kept her in a cold room with no bed, blanket, or pillow, and didn't give her anything to eat other than a cookie and some soda.
Even though she was a U.S. citizen, CBP ultimately deported the little girl. She returned to the U.S. 3 weeks later and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
The fact is, it's not necessary to abuse citizens and permanent residents or anyone to do the work of a Customs and Border Protection official. And yet, there aren't any meaningful mechanisms holding Customs and Border Protection officials in check. And so there's a real sense of impunity.
Lyle says this is partially due to the sheer size of CBP, which has grown into the largest federal law enforcement agency in the country.
With that growth, there was no accompanying rise in transparency, oversight, accountability that you would expect to see from any law enforcement agency, much less one that claims such broad authority. The picture that emerges is really of an agency that's grown too much, too far, too fast, and is at times operating really as an agency out of control.
For weeks, I've been trying, unsuccessfully, to get someone from CBP or DHS headquarters to respond to direct questions about detainment policies. During my detainment, I tried asking the guy in charge, Supervisor McPherson, why we were held for so long. He said it wasn't my right to know. I asked him the names of the agents who interacted with us while we were detained, and was once again told it wasn't my right to know. Earlier this week, I called Richard Misdell, the public affairs liaison at the Buffalo Service Port, and asked him if McPherson's response was in line with CBP policy.
You know, in a situation like that, normally we would provide the names of the officers, but in this instance, he did give you his name, so...
Well, he didn't give me his name. I wrote it down because he was facing me and I could write it down. He wouldn't give me his first name. When I asked for the names of the other agents, they turned around so I couldn't write their names down. Mm-hmm. Is it against CBP policy for U.S. citizens to have the names of the agents they interact with?
I would have to investigate that for you. I wouldn't want to speculate.
So you don't know?
I'd have to investigate that for you.
Is it the CBP policy not to inform people of why they're being held for extended periods of time?
Each situation is different. To try to make a statement broad enough to cover all would be, you know, asinine. There's no way that could be done.
Later, we learned that other friends that had been at the wedding in Toronto were also detained, also for 6 hours, at the Detroit border crossing. Khalid Ahmed and his wife were driving with their two small children, his brother, and a family friend. Again, all U.S. citizens. They said their first interaction with a CBP agent signaled what was to come.
You know, I was like, hi, how are you doing today? No response. Stern look from the beginning. Who's Khalid? Are you Khalid? Yes, I'm Khalid. Who's Lubab? Lubab right here. Okay, which one is Muna? That's Muna. At this point in time, my son, who had just turned 3 years old, was in the back seat. He kind of popped his head out and he's like, hi, my name is Fethi. He just turned to him. He's like, what? What did you say your name was? What's your name? Really aggressively to this three-year-old kid.
They were told to park and leave all their cell phones in the car, at which point his wife, Ala, asked if anyone would be going through their phones.
Because I wear a headscarf, I have pictures on there that if somebody's going to search the phone, I need it to be a female.
And the man said that nobody was going to be checking our phones. So we went ahead and left our phones in the car.
My phone doesn't have a code, but Khalid's does have a lock. So they brought it in and they told him, we need you to unlock your phone. We're going to search through it.
It went from, we won't search your phones, to, we're going to search your phone, confiscate it, and not give it back to you. I got into an argument with the officer. I said, listen, all my work is on my phone. I really need it. He got aggressive with me and said, listen, you're not leaving with your phone today.
Khalid told me he put his foot down about his phone because he saw another friend who was detained that day do the same thing. When Khalid's group arrived at the Detroit border crossing, they found Ahmed Gdoura, another Toronto wedding guest and U.S. citizen, already being detained with his family at the CBP facility.
I just kept on begging him. I'm like, you can't take my phone. This is my work phone. I'm on call 24/7, so I have to have my phone. And after begging them, he said, you can come tomorrow to pick it up.
If you cross the border and the government takes your cell phone or one of your electronic devices, the safe assumption to make, because you just don't know, is the government has made a copy of that device.
ACLU attorney Catherine Crump says that the government can search people's electronic devices at the border without any suspicion that they contain evidence of wrongdoing.
And you know, once the government has a copy of someone's electronic information, it's relatively easy for that to be shared among government agencies, and the policy even permits sharing with state and local governments and with foreign governments, too.
Back at Niagara Falls, we had our phones confiscated as well, and my husband was asked to unlock his. The government says only around 15 of the 1.1 million people who enter the U.S. each day have their electronic devices searched by Border Patrol agents. If that's true, our three cars may have accounted for almost all of CBP's device searches that day. DHS has an internal office of civil rights and civil liberties, which Crump says encourages CBP agents to write an explanation of why a device search is taking place. But it's not a requirement, though she thinks it should be.
Because anything you can do to make people create some record of why they're conducting searches would help cut down on searches that are conducted for impermissible reasons, such as, for example, merely because of the racial or ethnic background of the person involved or because of their religious beliefs.
When my husband Abdullah was taken to another room for interrogation by a DHS officer, the questions quickly focused on his religious beliefs.
He asks me if I'm Muslim, but he kind of does it in this weird way. Like, he's like, can I ask you, what religion are you? Like that, you know, like it kind of like dances around it. And I was like, yes, I'm Muslim. He said, are you practicing? I said, yes. He said, where do you practice? And I was immediately confused by that question because, I mean, Muslims don't really belong to a church or a mosque or whatever. I said, I practice wherever.
We've noticed a pattern of CBP agents asking Muslim travelers really invasive and personal questions about their protected religious activity.
Munya Jabbar, an attorney at the Council on American-Islamic Relations, says questions about religious behavior violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
You're singling out people based on their religion and then subjecting them to longer detentions and to humiliating questioning about stuff that they're allowed to do legally. In fact, stuff that is part of the bedrock of our Bill of Rights.
What about the people who say, okay, well, so what? We inconvenience a few Muslims. We ask them some questions that might be uncomfortable or invasive, but whatever, if they're not doing anything wrong, no big deal. In the meantime, we might potentially catch somebody who is actually a threat to this country. Isn't it worth it?
No, because the questions are just so broad. I don't possibly see how those kinds of questions would actually help them flesh out any kind of terrorism investigation. When you pull aside innocent people for questioning, there's a stigma that they have done something wrong, and that stigma is also harmful.
I got called in at least 5 or 6 separate occasions. Every single time they called me in, they would search me.
That's Khalid.
Aggressively search me, push my forehead up against the concrete wall, going in between my legs, digging in my private areas. They send me back for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes and call me back again and search me again.
Did you ask them why they had to do a body search every time?
I just laughed. The only way I knew how to deal with it was laugh. I just kept laughing. I was like, do you have any weapons on you? No, sir. You just searched me, and I went and sat back down in the same seat. I don't know where you think I could have gotten weapons from, you know? At some point, to get over the depression of the situation, you just have to treat it as a joke.
Some of the treatment, I think, can be fairly dehumanizing. For example, when CBP cuffs a parent in front of their kids, that can be terrifying to families, and it seems really needlessly terrifying.
And that's exactly what happened to Khalid at the Detroit border.
After we had been there about 5.5 hours, a man came out, put handcuffs on me, and took me to a back room that was basically a jail cell. They didn't tell me what was going on. My only request is I just asked one of them, whenever you guys find out what's going on, can you please just tell my family? Can you just inform my family?
Not only did they not tell his family what was going on, they led them to think the worst. While Khalid was still in the jail cell, the rest of his group got their passports back and were told they could leave. Here's his wife, Ella.
Khalid's brother asked, you know, where's Khalid? And I just told him, oh, I'm sure he's coming out right now. And then when I've already walked away from the desk, the agent tells me, oh, he won't be joining you guys. I was like, what? You know, I go up to the desk and like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, there's an agency coming to pick him up. I was like, well, what agency? He's like, I can't disclose that information with you. I was like, he's my husband. You need to tell me where he is going. We waited here 6 hours. We're American citizens. Don't treat us like we're criminals. Don't treat us like we've done something wrong. And he made it seem like it was the FBI coming to get him, like this was something serious. And then I just broke down.
Turned out, Khalid had an unpaid ticket for having a crooked license plate, which he got back in 2006. The other agency coming to get him was Michigan State Police.
I really don't understand the rationale of terrifying and humiliating families in that manner with those kind of tactics.
Munya Jabbar.
CBP apparently has essentially a kind of customer service notice up in their facilities, but they're definitely not following through on that kind of customer service.
I saw that customer service notice when I was being detained. It was a list of CBP's pledges to travelers entering the U.S. I read some of those out to my friends and family to see how well they thought CBP did.
We pledge to cordially greet and welcome you to the United States.
I mean, that was anything but cordial. It was definitely not a welcome. It was more like a, you are not welcome.
We pledge to treat you with courtesy, dignity, and respect.
There was not a single courtesy given. Even the bathroom was an ordeal. It was an uphill battle. Absolutely no dignity at all. We were antagonized from the start. From the cold air to the terrible seats to the heightened tension and the fact that they were kind of laughing on their end of the room, kind of looking over at us like we were huddled sheep for the slaughter.
It was one of the lowest moments of dignity in my life.
We pledge to explain the CBP process to you.
Never. Not once did anybody explain to us what was happening or what procedures were to be followed. or anything.
It was almost like a joke, like a Saturday Night Live sketch. Like saying, we pledge to put you in a black room and they put us in a white room, for example. They would just do literally the opposite of everything that they said.
I repeatedly asked Richard Mizdal, the one CBP official I managed to get on the line, why our detainment was so starkly different than the experience CBP promises travelers, and repeatedly got the same response.
The way that we would handle the situation, ma'am, and I know it's going to sound like a broken record here, but is through DHS TRIP. DHS TRIP, what they'll do is they'll take all the information. It all goes to headquarters. Headquarters looks at the information. They disseminate it down to the port level. The port level goes through, talks to all the key components that were involved with the case. They'll write up a response to it, and the response will go to headquarters, and headquarters will issue it to you.
The complainant is unlikely to receive any information about the course of the investigation. They very regularly receive a cursory dismissal letter.
ACLU attorney James Lyle.
I heard one case of someone who submitted a complaint to the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and they were referred to the TRIP program. And then in turn, the TRIP program, when it was done processing their information, referred them back to OCRCL, a kind of bureaucratic hot potato.
Really?
Yeah.
Referred them back for what?
Further investigation, supposedly.
And remember Ahmed Gudura, whose phone was kept overnight? He's often experienced difficulty at border crossings, so he actually went through DHS TRIP and obtained a redress number, presumably to make travel easier in the future.
This past time, the first guy, when he takes your passports, I told him I have a redress number. He's like, I don't need it. It's not going to make a difference. I was held for 7 hours, and that was the longest I've ever been held. And this is after I've gotten a redress number. I feel like I'm a second-class citizen, where every time I'm trying to get into the country, you get dehumanized, you get treated like an animal, pretty much.
They make you feel like a foreigner in your own country. And that's the psychology of it, you know. Honestly, like, it's still kind of throwing me off. They really mess with your head while you're in there.
To be in a situation where you're a father and you can't protect your children or do anything for them, it's not easy to sit through, to feel so helpless.
This is my home, so it was very much a betrayal, a cocktail of emotions, anger, sadness, depression, hopelessness, helplessness. And I remember anger slowly, slowly rising to the top, eclipsing all other ones, because I just felt like I did not deserve this. I am not a criminal. I am not in possession of anything illegal. I am an American. Open the damn door and let me back home.
For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
Sarah joins us in the studio now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brooke.
So you wanted to do an investigation because of what happened to you, but what you ended up with was an indictment.
Yeah, I genuinely came out of the experience wondering what our rights are. I approached CBP and DHS headquarters asking very direct questions
like,
you know, is there a time limit on how long someone can be detained? Do people have to unlock their phones if asked? Do agents have to inform you why you're being detained? And I didn't even approach them as like an angry citizen. I approached them as a journalist who had very straightforward questions just about the process and the protocol. And what I discovered doing that is that the lack of transparency that I saw during our detainment just continued up and up and up the ranks all the way to D.C., where nobody was getting back to me about anything.
How many times did you actually try?
Oh, I tried a bunch of times. I don't even know. I mean, I made phone calls. I sent emails. I tried to get DHS. I tried to get the Civil Liberties and Civil Rights Office. I tried to get CBP. People would just send me links to their website, which I can access by myself. I don't need them to send me links to the website.
Well, let's talk about the Civil Rights Office. We couldn't fit this into the piece, but the Department of Homeland Security's Civil Rights Unit did its own investigation of rights violations at the border. It pretty much exonerated the CBP and then classified its report. Now, the ACLU told you that when it finally got the report, the Civil Rights Office had redacted its reasons for clearing the CBP. This is just weird.
Yeah, and everybody that I talk to gave me the impression that the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Office is pretty much a toothless unit within the Department of Homeland Security. It's strange to me that even those oversight agencies are opaque. Not releasing a report about the impact of device searches on our civil liberties, that's strange. Having that report be FOIA'd and then releasing it with huge chunks of it redacted is also strange. Ultimately, it seems like from top to bottom, people can just fall back on, you know, it's sensitive information, we can't tell you. And the danger in that is They can say that about anything.
You always felt yourself to be untouchable, even though you wear a headscarf and you're from a place where there's searing heat and endless numbers of guns.
And oil.
Yeah.
Texas.
Exactly.
I'm from Texas. That was one of the hardest things when we were done with our detainment. I really just felt so stupid. Like, how naive was I to think that when we came back into the country, all smiles and happy to be home, that this wouldn't happen? You know, you always hear this over and over and over again. You don't do anything wrong. You've got nothing to hide. You're fine. And I really thought, if there's due process, if there's a legal system, and I haven't done anything wrong, then nobody will treat me that way. And if somebody does treat me that way, there's going to be some sort of accountability later for that. And what I'm discovering is there's nothing that any of us can do. Absolutely nothing. Those guys at the front lines that have no oversight on what they're doing, they're the invincible ones.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
OTM producer Sarah Abderrahman. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children, at AECF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at Hewlett.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. I once worked in an office which opened into a hall. My boss was in the next office. Once, as I was leaving, I heard him suppressing laughter. Why? Because every single time I walked out my door, I turned in the wrong direction and had to double back. I am very directionally challenged. So I live by Google Maps. A Pew Research report last week found that 74% of smartphone-owning adults use phone apps to get information based on their location, restaurants and shops, and most important for me, which way to walk.
Turn left. Turn right. You've arrived at your destination.
But as the ancients asked, does the walker choose the path? Or the path, the walker. A recently launched website called Ghetto Tracker affixes safety ratings to specific areas on maps so you can avoid walking into a neighborhood it deems dodgy, as its controversial name implies. But geographer Jim Thatcher notes that other navigational apps do pretty much the same thing in ways far less blatant than the folks at Ghetto Tracker.
Certain people are saying these areas are quote-unquote ghetto, and that you should avoid them. You don't know who those people are. You don't know their motivations, but that's where it's coming from. What's interesting to me is that Ghetto Tracker got so much attention, whereas we already have tools that are doing the same thing, but are using algorithms to do it, and no one is talking about those.
You think that's worse than an individual going, wow, there's a lot of people here of color. I'm going to warn people to stay away?
Okay. With Ghetto Tracker, it's really clear that they're doing that. With these other ones that have a non-publicly accessible algorithm, it's hidden what they're doing.
Microsoft issued a patent in 2012 called Pedestrian Route Prediction. The media dubbed this project as the Avoid Ghetto app. My understanding is that the app bases its algorithm on weather, crime statistics, and demographic information. Since users don't know what data specifically the app is pulling from, that's where your problem is?
Yes. Microsoft may or may not ever put this technology into one of their products. But we have no way of knowing that these decisions are being made. How are they using demographic information? Are they saying, well, this area has a medium income of X, therefore, this user with an income of Y would not like to go there.
This past July, it was announced that Waze, W-A-Z-E, which is a geographic navigation app, was bought by Google for $1.3 billion. So why are they worth so much money?
Waze, at its core, provides real-time traffic updates by collecting information from its 40 million users. When they turn the app on, they start monitoring where you're going and what speed you're traveling at. I'm sure they grab other information as well. Google already could do that on any phone that was running Android. So why are they willing to pay so much to buy Waze? Well, anytime you can add 40 to 50 million new sources of data, that's incredibly valuable.
We are being sold for our data. It's an old story. But I still wonder how it might affect our route.
I'm at point A, and I want to get to the closest coffee shop. If you're using Google Maps, it can theoretically say to any five coffee shops nearby, hey, how much are you willing to pay us to send a customer to you?
It may have the potential, but does it do it?
It's not being used fully right now. But what we're seeing is a huge jockeying to position themselves to be the best at doing this. The purchase of Waze, Microsoft's patent, there's this sort of gold rush to figure out how to effectively do this.
So what's the downside here, really, Jim?
Several things. It's very, very easy to remove areas. You can end up eliding entire areas of experience. As these applications route us through cities and around obstacles, whether they're traffic jams or just areas where someone has paid more to send us down that street, there can be a feedback loop that develops. You're encouraged to behave in a way that is defined by this computer application. It then starts rewarding you.
So we make fewer and fewer judgments, and I guess that feels good.
Yeah. In the interviews I've done of end users of mobile phones, I've found that they often experience a real pleasure in sort of being placed on the map. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. You don't have to keep in your mind where everything is. You've got this thing that does it for you. But what's on the map and what's not becomes decided through this completely hidden process calculated in the interest of for-profit corporations. And I know a lot of people always say, oh, but, you know, corporations aren't that bad. Well, there's absolutely no reason to believe that governments couldn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's your cup of tea or your style of paranoia, there's plenty to be worried about there, too.
Jim, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Jim Thatcher is a geographer at Clark University. Marshall Berman, the great philosopher of modernism, died on the 11th at the age of 72 of a heart attack while eating breakfast with a friend at a diner in the city he loved, New York. It seems, if much too soon, at least fitting, he died in dialogue. He believed dialogue to be an urgent need in modern times because our subjectivity and inwardness have intensified, a state he called both richer and more lonely. That's why, he wrote, communication is both a desperate need and a primary source of delight. In a world where meanings melt into air, these experiences are among the few solid sources of meaning we can count on. One of the things that makes modern life worth living is the enhanced opportunities it offers us, and sometimes even forces on us, to talk together, to reach and understand each other. Now, the argument over the internet's power to intensify our inwardness versus its ability to engender dialogue never ends. But the intrepid Clive Thompson has conducted a thorough search of the digital landscape and makes his case for the latter in his new book, Smarter Than You Think: How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He's come a long way from where he began as a geekily engaged 25-year-old back in the 90s.
So I guess it was probably around 94, 95, when people started coming online in droves. I thought, well, this is terrible. And I was convinced that the average person could not be trusted with the keys to the internet.
Here you were, a mere babe in your 20s, and you're screaming at the kids to get off your lawn?
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of 25-year-old men are pretty sure of their opinions. When you sit at your desk, it's easy to believe that the average person is really stupid and the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But when you start reporting and actually going out there and talking to people and seeing what they do, I think the reporting saved me because I just realized that a lot of the things I was worried about, they came to pass, some of them, but they weren't as bad as I thought, and I did not at all predict the amazing stuff.
You launched the book with the story of supercomputer Deep Blue beating Garry Kasparov at chess, which is a moment that was seen as a Rubicon when human brain power fell short. But as you go on to report, the answer to the question, who's smarter, humans or computers, is both.
That's right, because what Kasparov did next is really interesting. He put together a new form of chess called advanced chess, where you have one human and a laptop facing down against another human and a laptop. The humans could do what they're good at, which is, you know, intuition, rattling their opponent, and the computers could take care of if-then possibilities and letting them consult the history of chess. So normally chess players are somewhat conservative. They stick to a very simple line of play they do over and over again. And what happened was that the chess suddenly became unbelievably complicated and creative and daring. And this really is a metaphor for what I do in the book, where I'm trying to say, what does it mean when we stop thinking in isolation and start thinking with each other and with computer assistance?
What you call in the book the centaur, the man-machine meld that creates, if not a super being, at least a better skilled one.
Yes. Every time someone goes on Facebook and says, does anyone know this? And a bunch of people who they have sort of forgotten that they even know happen to notice this at the corner of their eye and chime in. That's collaborative thinking in its most simple form. One of the things that's great about thinking out loud is that you begin to realize that there are other people who you would never have predicted are thinking about the same thing as you. Scientists actually have a phrase for this. They call it multiples, where two or three different scientists will come up with the exact same idea at the exact same time all around the world without knowing of the other's existence.
Like, you know, Newton and Leibniz and the calculus?
Yep. Or like Charles Darwin with the theory of evolution. He invented it and then he sat on it for years until he got a letter from another young academic saying, I have this idea. I think you're interested in this stuff too. The typewriter was invented at least five or six times, the telescope by four people, the logarithm by two different people, and always within a year of each other. So there's something about our environment that means that ideas come to life when they're sort of ready to come to life.
And so how does the digital environment influence that?
What's fantastic is that in the old days, people worked in isolation before realizing someone else around the world had the answer faster than them. In fact, studies of mathematicians found that one-third of them complained that they were toiling on something and they published it only to discover that someone a few cities away had the answer 2 years earlier, right? Mm. So knowing about what is going on in other people's minds helps resolve multiples and get those problems solved more quickly, or even just find someone to talk to about them.
Okay. But what about the children? Let's not forget the children. How do they learn to write if all they're ever producing are texts on their phones? And by the way, get off my lawn.
Again, get off my lawn, exactly. Young people definitely are writing a lot of stuff online, and a lot of it is quite silly, and there's all those short forms and whatnot. But practice is valuable, and it is hard to get young people to write stuff because when they went into school and you have to write an essay for the teacher, you don't really want to do it because there's no actual audience. There's an audience of one person, it's your teacher, and they're being paid to read your writing, so it's inauthentic. And every teacher has known this, and every student has known this, and that's why it's been historically really hard to get them to write. What has happened as, you know, young people have gone online and done what the rest of us have done, which is to realize, oh my goodness, there's these people I can talk to. They're my friends. They're strangers. There's different forums. They've started writing more than any generation has ever done in the past. Now, that idea that we are now talking and taking the thoughts out of our heads and putting them down and showing them and sharing them to other people is really one of the central trends throughout the whole book. And it has been persistently misunderstood, I think, by traditional scholars and journalists and thinkers because they're accustomed to writing and putting their ideas in public. In reality, for the rest of the population. It's transformatively new.
But all that minutia, Charlie's choice of entree, all that living out loud, what's the value of that for the rest of us?
You know, one tweet about one's lunch is kind of boring, but 300 of them starts to become oddly compelling in a weird way because I begin to get the sense of the contours of what's going on in my friend's life, particularly if they're, you know, they're talking about what they've seen, what they've read. It's called ambient awareness. It's the idea that if you pick up these little subtle cues into the work of someone else's mind, you begin to have a fantastic sense of what's happening in their intellectual life. And that has enormous value when you are trying to solve problems by knowing who's out there that you can talk to, when you can establish states of awareness amongst a group, where the group has a sense of its own abilities.
My favorite part of the book, probably, is the big chunk that's devoted to memory in the digital age. Specifically, I'm talking about Thad Starner. This is someone who had a prototype that helped develop Google Glass and who had incorporated it entirely into virtually every phase of his life.
Right, yeah.
And that seems wrong. You know, he's constantly recording and monitoring, and how can he be talking to you if he's consulting this little thing in the corner of his eye?
Yeah, I wondered about that. I mean, I'm sitting here with a guy that's had a computer on his head for 20 years, and he's got a screen that he's looking at. And my first thought was, this is going to be dreadful. I mean, he's going to be looking, doing Angry Birds on his screen while I'm trying to talk to him. But he, you know, he very carefully over years developed really good protocols for how and when to use it. One of his rules was only to be looking at notes that are germane to what you're talking about.
And by notes, he could call up on this little tiny head computer by using something in his hand, something that he'd written 10 years ago, that related to what you were talking about.
Exactly. He had over 2 million words of notes he'd written. And so we'd be talking about stuff, and he would go, oh, yes, and he'd bring up some amazingly erudite point that related to exactly what we were talking about because he had this stuff at his beck and call.
And you didn't see him actually writing these words in?
No. His one-handed keyboard, he's very fast with it. And he's not writing a huge amount. He's really only writing, you know, a few words here and there. Like, he's got it down to a real art and science of being able to record the most interesting things of a conversation, usually in breaks and pauses in the conversation, and then calling them up later on. And this was really enriching the conversation and not distracting from it at all. I realized that having this computer in his eye was less distracting for him than the phone was for me, because we were having coffee at a Starbucks, and we leave the Starbucks, we're walking across the street, and I've got my phone out because I'm trying to figure out where my hotel is. And I don't even notice I'm about to walk into a pothole filled with water, and it's Thad who goes, dude, look out where you're walking, you know. Turns out staring at a phone might be worse than having a computer in your eye that you know how to manage.
You wrote that the real power of digital memories is to trigger our human memories. But if you can't access this mountain of material that you've recorded and stored, if you can't sort through it the way that Thad did, then it's no good to us at all, is it? In fact, you cite a study that suggests if we know something is recorded, we'll forget it even sooner. So is this a real risk in the end?
It's definitely a concern. The more I looked at the profusion of recording we're doing, the more I learned that really one of the great skills of the next, you know, 20 to 30 years, we're going to have to learn how to deal with the enormous stores of memory we have and how to manage them so they're useful. A lot of this is going to become almost like library science of everyday life. You know, librarians 500 years ago began to grapple with there being tons of books, and they had to start thinking about how to prioritize them. And now we have to do that too.
And what about distraction? The last great criticism of this digital age, which is that it's like flickering lights on the periphery, and that is death to creativity.
I think that's actually right. That's the one criticism that I wholeheartedly endorse. I mean, the idea that digital media are making us trivial or shallow, I don't buy at all. We've been very good at being trivial and shallow for centuries. I certainly was before the internet came along. But the idea that we are now more distracted, I think, is absolutely true and is borne out by the research. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are trying to do too much at a time on these little devices. You know, you open up your phone or your computer, and it's not really a single phone or a single computer. What it really is a gateway to about 6 or 7 multinational companies that are trying to grab your eyeballs and sell you ads. So they're constantly sending you these alerts saying, please look at me, you know, please do this. And when I first started working on the book, I thought maybe there's some amazing high-tech solution for this, right? Like maybe there's some software out there that could save us from all these distractions. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized there is no silver bullet. There is really only, you know, what the philosophers of attention have always called mindfulness. And this is really what I'm writing about here. I mean, if you grant the force of my argument that these new technologies catalyze and push us into new types of thinking that are productively useful, right? You know, connected thinking, social thinking, that it's also good to think in the non-digital ways that we enjoyed for decades before. You know, the more solitary thinking, face-to-face interactions, and you need to build that into your life. I mean, religious traditions and unions had it right when they pushed for the weekend Sabbath, right? You know, they understood 7 days a week of being always on is a bad thing. Now, I'm not a monk about this. I actually, if someone asks me a question I can't answer, I Google it on the weekends, and I do text a lot. But by and large, I've tried to sort of do the Sabbath, and it works pretty well for me.
You don't play video games on the weekends?
Oh, yeah, I play video games on the weekends. I've recently gotten into what's known as Japanese bullet hell games.
I'm glad you really unplug and kick back on your Sabbath.
I read books, too.
Clive, thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun.
Clive Thompson is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. I think that the departed bard of modernism, Marshall Berman, would have deemed Clive a modernist. In his masterwork, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, Berman wrote that, quote, to be modern is to experience personal and social life as a maelstrom, to find one's world and one's self in perpetual disintegration and renewal, trouble and anguish, ambiguity and contradiction, to be part of a universe in which all that is solid melts into air. But to be a modernist, he wrote, is to make oneself somehow at home in the maelstrom, to make its rhythms one's own, to move within its currents in search of the forms of reality, of beauty, of freedom, of justice that its fervid and perilous flow allows. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abderrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Rima Kreis. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian, and it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman. Kat Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.